Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to the Beauty and the Beast Physical Therapy and Strength Conditioning Podcast. I am joined by my co-host, Dr. Ross Childs.
Hey, guys. Hope everyone's doing well. Feels like it's been a while since we've done this, but we try to keep up with it every week. Hope everyone's doing well, especially the dads out there. Happy belated Father's Day. Kind of a shitty weekend being in Maine, but it's always nice to get away. Now, did I see you post a card online?
Yeah, I got a Father's Day card from my stepdaughter, first time ever. So that was
pretty cool. That's huge.
Yeah, it was. It was huge, and it felt good. It was good.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, RJ made me this little handwritten one, and it was like, thanks, Dad, for making me to live. And I'm like, you know what? That's perfect.
It's accurate.
I absolutely love it. So we're back at it this week. We appreciate everyone's comments over the last couple episodes. Today we're going to kind of talk about, not kind of, we will talk about two syndromes, and they're not even really syndromes, but I know Adam, I have mentioned them in the past, but they're called upper and lower cross syndrome. So we wanted to kind of just clear the air on what they are and what they are not, and then what we can do about them, because in my opinion, pretty much everyone has either one or the other, or you can have both. So I know that there are times that I have it, and there I'm sure there's times that you've probably noticed you've had it, but what can we do about it? So, Adam, in your opinion, how prevalent is upper and lower cross syndrome? And we'll go over the definitions after this.
I mean, I think it's pretty prevalent just in the lifestyles that most of us live. I mean, even people that are active, even if people that, you know, work out an hour a day. Let's say somebody works out 7 days a week for an hour a day. There's still a lot of time that they would have to offset in order to stave off having some amount of upper or lower body cross. I'm not saying that everyone has, I mean, everybody has degrees of it, I believe, just because, you know, we are seated when we drive. When we're seated, our arms are forward. And this will make more sense when we explain what they are for those of you that don't know. But you're on the computer, you're on your phone, you're driving, everything is hands in front of you, knees bent in a, you know, seated position for hours at a time. Even if you make the concerted effort to get up and move and all that sort of stuff, there's still going to be some amount of it. It just, the degrees vary from person to person.
Now, the thing that I want to point out, and I'm very glad you brought this up, you talked about the habits that we do, the lifestyles that we live. So even though we use the word syndrome, it is not a true syndrome. It's an environment that we live in. So now to get to the actual definitions of it. So upper and lower cross syndrome have to do with over-facilitation of certain muscles followed by under-facilitation of others, or inhibited for that matter. So we need to think of the body always wanting to remain on an even keel. If one side of the body becomes a plus one, the other side has to become a minus one just to stay at homeostasis. And that's really all it is. Now, upper cross syndrome pertains to the muscles that are basically going to be north of the thoracic spine, or the middle of the body. So for example, and as Adam talked about arms being in front of us, our chest muscles tend to become very, very short. So with that, that's an over-facilitation. Now, what the body will then do is then generally the opposite side of the body has to become weaker or less efficient. So if my chest muscles are too strong, then my back muscles then have to weaken themselves a little bit to offset it. The other compensation that we'll typically see associated with those two muscles are that now my neck muscles become way too tight, and then the muscles that basically control the small little neck movements become too weak. So it looks like we have a forward head posture with rounded shoulders. Now, what I typically find is that a lot of people generally complain about their mid-back, between the shoulder blades, more than the tightness in their neck and in their chest. Not a lot of people have been able to explain that. Do you have any theory as to why they feel in between their shoulder blades when they're experiencing upper cross syndrome?
As opposed to noticing it in their neck?
Correct.
I think it's probably just because a lot of us, everything is either very in front of us or very just slightly skewed left or right. I would think there's a lot more times that I mean, this is totally just like you asked me this and I'm just thinking on the fly, but there are a lot more times I feel like that your arms are extended forward, therefore lengthening those muscles between the shoulder blade and the spine, versus how often you're actually, you know, looking to your right, looking to your left, that kind of thing, where you might notice the tight neck muscles a little bit more. I mean, obviously when you're driving, but yeah. Even people with tightness in their neck can turn their entire torso. So they might not even notice that their neck is necessarily, in quotes, tight.
Yeah.
But they are liable to notice that the upper back is tight.
Exactly. You know, and that's oftentimes people can't explain that. Or they'll say, oh, maybe your back muscles are tight. Well, it doesn't make sense if they're tight if the shoulder blades are being pulled apart. So it's when those muscles are now trying to work even harder, but they're under that eccentric load trying to offset the pull of the chest muscles. So really we have a couple different options. We can either stretch what's tight, which in this case would be our pecs and our upper traps, or we can strengthen what's weak, which could be our deep neck flexors, or it could be strengthening the scapular muscles or the mid back muscles. When you experience a client or when you had members that had upper cross syndrome, would you prefer to strengthen the weak muscles or would you try to stretch the tight muscles?
If I had to pick only one, it would be strengthen the weak muscles, but ideally it's a combination of both. It's with the people that have the really severe shoulder stuff going on, what I usually like to do is I really don't do a lot of stretching or mobility when it comes to the back muscles. I'll have them stretch or, you know, lacrosse ball their pecs to loosen it up and then compound that effect by strengthening the back. So you create more tissue length on one side, and then you turn the muscles on the other side so it pulls you into a little bit different posture. Which, yep. I mean, you have to do over time for it to be a lasting change, but that's the way I normally approach it.
Yeah, I don't necessarily think that I have one preferred method over the other. You know, if I find something that's tight, you know, and in the case of the upper trap and the pec, it's very easy to give, you know, a neck stretch and a doorway stretch. And then I'll typically see, you know, banded pull-aparts or whatnot. It's very easy to do all of them at the same time. And I typically find that the rotator cuff is a little jacked up too, just because it's not in the right position. So a little softball work, a little strengthening, a little stretching goes a long way. But if we think of it from a neurological standpoint, if something is over-facilitated, then our body from a nervous system standpoint under-facilitates. So if we just turn on those muscles that are a little bit weaker, then in theory, those muscles in the front are going to have to turn themselves down too. So you could get away with retraining those habits without even having to stretch. Now, where people, I feel, they go wrong is they're not fully aware of the habit or the environment that they live in the first place. We've talked about this before on other podcasts. If you give someone a standard, like a banded row, so for those of you that are listening, so standing up, you wrap the band around something stationary, and then you're just trying to pull the band towards your chest. What are some of the compensation patterns that we'll find with those who do a banded row?
The two biggest ones I often see is, number one, as their hands get closer to their chest, their shoulders start to dive forward. So their elbows keep, they basically are trying to drive their elbows so far past their body that their shoulders actually tip forward. Imagine you have two cups of water on either shoulder and they fall forward as you pull the band back. That one, and they reach with their chin when they get to a certain point.
Correct. So all they're doing is just reinforcing that bad pattern that we're trying to get them out of in the first place. So we really have to make sure that we're teaching them those fine movements where it's, okay, keep your head back the whole time, keep the shoulder blades back the whole time, and if you're doing this correctly, your body won't let you overcompensate for it. So it's quite remarkable when we look at stabilization features of the body, like the scapular retractors or the shoulder blade muscles, for example. If you pin those all the way back, your body will not allow you to dump forward the way that you described, and it won't allow you to use excessive shoulder extension, which is similar to what you were talking about as well. However, even though it's the preferred pattern, or I shouldn't even say that, even though it's the correct biomechanical motion, the body will still find the path of least resistance. And that in itself is what creates these syndromes. Now with lower cross syndrome, I know we started to talk about interventions or ways to correct it, and we'll go into this a little bit deeper. Lower cross syndrome is the same concept, but it's applied below the low back and pelvis now. So typically we're going to see the hip flexors or the muscles in the front of the hip are going to be over-facilitated. And then if we go opposite side of the body, the glutes are going to be a little bit weaker. Now with that, we're also going to see if we go above the glutes, the low back muscles are going to be tight. So again, if you're looking at someone from the side and you draw tight muscle to tight muscle and then weak muscle to weak muscle, it creates an X. And that's where that cross comes from. So if my low back muscles are tightening too much to create extension because my glutes can't, then we also have to assume that my core muscles are not doing that job either. So if someone has a lower cross syndrome, they typically have an increased lordosis, an increased curve in their low back with an anterior pelvic tilt. Now, Adam, in your experience, if someone has an increased lordosis with an anterior pelvic tilt, potentially from lower cross syndrome, and they try to do a plank, what area of their body do they say hurts?
Lower back.
Their low back. And why is that?
Because that's where all the pressure is.
Correct.
The body's not supporting, the musculature of the abdominals and the hips are not supporting the spine, so all that pressure is just going into the lumbar spine.
And probably the same thing with push-ups.
Yeah.
Because really it's the same motion. And it almost looks like their stomach is sagging, but it's just the curvature. So again, we have two options. We can either go about strengthening the weak or stretching the tight. But again, we have to remember this is habitual. So just going to the gym once and trying these exercises will not fix this. You have to apply these concepts either during daily life or every time you go to the gym, you have to be applying these principles. So Adam, do you have anything to add on upper and lower cross syndrome, what it is?
No, I just think that, I mean, you and I have talked about this before. I think this is starting to become a catch-all for a lot of, maybe not people, but professionals. I hear a lot of people now say, oh, I have lower body cross, I have upper body cross. And it's kind of like, well, it's kind of like when we talked about patellofemoral syndrome.
That's what I was just thinking in my
head. It's a description of a disorder without necessarily giving, or disorder in quotes. It's, you know what I mean. I know that's a taboo-ish word now, but it doesn't get to the heart of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because probably 9 out of every 10 people that a physical therapist sees has some measure of upper or lower body cross.
Sure. Well, and what's interesting about it is we're now, they're taking this upper and lower cross, which is an environment we live in, and they're turning it into a condition, which it's not. But when you look at the word syndrome, so the actual definition, I just pulled it up. So it's a group of symptoms which consistently occur together or a condition characterized by a set of associated symptoms. So I guess that could fit in with upper and lower cross syndrome, but there are multiple people that have upper and lower cross syndrome without symptoms. You know, those would be signs, so not necessarily symptoms. However, the other definition is a characteristic combination of opinions, emotions, and behaviors. So if that's the case, if you're looking at that definition, okay, it's a behavior, it's a habit. The syndrome is the behavior, but it's the environment we live in because it's the behavior that they're always assuming. So the best way that we can combat that is by doing the exact opposite of what our body prefers. And I've talked about reverse posturing and stuff like that. And that's usually, I'm referencing repeated motion testing, McKenzie, and stuff like that. But in this case, okay, if my head is hanging forward, what's the easiest thing I can do to correct that?
Pull your head back.
Oh, holy shit. I mean, that's amazing.
$50, please.
I'm telling you. You better charge more than that.
Copay.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's just the copay.
Oh, my God. So, and I mean, yes, we can joke around because it's pretty easy to us. It's obvious. But what amazes me is you go to any commercial gym, you ask someone, oh, I'm fixing my posture, yet they have a shitty posture on that exercise.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily that they know they're using the shitty posture, but their body has assumed a posture that feels like it's good at that given time. So, and that's why, for when you work with clients and when I work with patients, we have to be nitpicky. You know, it's like, no, you do it this way. All right, now remember this, now remember that. From a motor control standpoint, again, we should never try to do more than two commands at the same time. The brain won't remember, but that's why we do it. So a lot of people, why are you, you're busting my balls, or you're being really nitpicky today. Well, if you don't master these little things, you're not going to get that functional advantage in the end. So now what do we do about it? You know, that's really the big question. So when someone has upper cross syndrome, what are some things that you have them perform? What are some exercises, but what are some cues that you give them?
So one of my favorite ones with rows is, so a lot of people with rows say, you know, pull the shoulders back, squeeze the shoulder blades, pretend there's a $50 bill between your upper back, don't let me take the $50 bill. I always like thinking down and back, like we're trying to bring our shoulder blades together, but then to the opposite back pocket. In classes, I would cue people by, you know, I'd say, okay, squeeze my fingers, and between their upper back. And I don't know why I felt the need to make sure that was in there. Just, it came out all kinds of wrong.
Yeah, because you heard me laughing.
Right. So, and what's funny is that 9 times out of 10, when you do that, like, let's say it's I usually make it around mid-back. That's not necessarily where they're going to be able to, in quotes, squeeze real well. But it just gets the thought process of not just back, but also down and back.
Mm-hmm.
And how many people, when you do that, they squeeze their upper, like, you know, 5 or 6 inches above where my fingers are. And then, like, nope, down here.
Upper traps all day long.
Right. And then you, okay, nope, down here. Oh, that does feel better. I always liked, again, elbow to the opposite back pocket. Things like that that always worked well for me on rows. You know, not letting people hang their head down. If, you know, you're doing a bench row, like, same knee and hand on the bench, pulling the dumbbell up, a lot of people will just, like, let their head drop, almost like so they're looking back towards their knees.
Sure.
They want to pull their, you want to pull their chin back. Realistically, even just, like, staring directly at the hand that's braced on the bench, things like that are the two biggest ones, I think, for me.
You're correct on that, but now I'm going to go off tangent a little bit.
Go for it.
Technically. It's not necessarily about upper and lower cross, but you talked about a dumbbell row. So you've probably seen the one where people are going in an arc of motion instead of going straight up and down.
Oh, yeah. They, like, come to the hip.
Yeah, where they're kind of pulling. Kind of, it's like this weird arc of motion.
Oh, yeah.
What are your thoughts on that? So the theory behind it is it's going to stimulate the lats more.
Sure.
But what are your thoughts on that?
Whatever. Like, if you're, I mean, if you're getting correct shoulder blade motion, I don't.
The straight up and down works just
fine. I don't see the reason for it. I see it for, because I know in the past when I've had people that really couldn't get the feeling of what, like, what I was saying when I said down and back,
mm-hmm.
or something along those lines, I'd sometimes have them almost pull that shoulder back or turn the, so the palm was forward, so they're even more into that, kind of that pattern that you're talking of, but almost as an extreme example to get them out of whatever pattern they seem to be stuck in.
Mm-hmm.
I personally don't think it's necessary. Yeah, just, I mean, I suppose, I don't know, if you're a,
everything works at some point.
Right. If you're a top bodybuilder and you need that last little 0.5% difference, and your lats are the one spot that are lacking when you turn around and you flex. I don't know that much about bodybuilding, but or about, like, competitions with bodybuilding.
Yeah.
Then I suppose maybe, but for 99.9999999% of people, it's stupid and it's more liable to throw you off because you're trying to do something so.
It's not a straight plane motion.
Right?
That's
yeah.
My problem,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
So then you see these people taking heavy weights. And now it's basically they're just swinging the weight, and it's an arc of motion. So, and I think that, you know, there are many downfalls of social media. There are many positives. Trust me, there are many nights that I just laugh my night away at social media. But there, one of the downfalls of social media is someone gets this great idea about an exercise, or they read about it somewhere, they post about it, and then everyone fucking does it. And that's one of the exercises that I said, do this for lat activation. Well, what about a pull-up?
I was just gonna say, get your hands on a goddamn chin up.
What about a pull down?
Yeah.
What about just doing a heavy straight plane row, just straight up and down?
Yeah.
And I don't know when did we care about this bullshit? It's kind of like everyone's got a different name, barbell thrusters.
Yeah.
Where they're on your hips, the hip thrusters.
Yeah.
Everyone called them something
glute
different.
Glute bridges, hip thrusters, whatever.
Yeah. I can remember doing those. Jeez, what am I? 39. So I can remember right around like 21, 22, 23. Mm-hmm. That was the first time Cressy really started talking about those. So, of course, Cressy says it. I'm doing it. All right, fine. And then it fell out of favor. And then fast forward, 15 years. And now all of a sudden it's all over social media. And now you see whoever's a fitness influencer, they have videos of themselves doing a barbell hip thrust.
Yeah.
Do you think it's really that good of an exercise?
I mean, I think it's an awesome exercise.
It's great exercise.
I think it's always been an awesome exercise.
But the attention that it's getting now.
Yeah.
Like, I knew it was good that long ago.
Right.
So what's different about it now compared to 15 years ago?
if you want my non-filtered answer, it's that big asses are in.
Yeah. attractive women on social. Not even attractive. Just all women who think they're a fitness influencer are doing it. And it's primarily females I see on social media that are doing it. But again, it's not a special exercise.
Right.
I guess when you've been doing this long enough, you've seen it all and history repeats itself.
Yeah.
It's going to fall out of favor. And guess what? 15 more years, it's going to come back.
Yeah.
Someone's going to call it something else. So it's a good exercise. I understand the basis of it.
Yeah.
I just, the amount of attention that it's getting, that's what annoys the shit out of me. It's no more special than any other exercise that we could do.
Yeah.
Like, if someone said to me, I'm perfectly healthy and I'm absolutely fine and I'm doing this barbell hip thruster or whatever the true name to it is instead of deadlifts, if there's no reason why you shouldn't be doing deadlifting, then I can't understand why you're going to be doing the barbell hip thrust instead. That would be a nice accessory lift.
Yeah, see I do. I was going to say, I do both.
Yeah.
I'll do both.
But if someone's replacing it,
right.
And then don't get me started on the sumo deadlift.
Oh, the only reason that I've used that in the past is I like it for people that don't have a lot of posterior chain strength, back of the body, but are really worried about deadlifting. Because, I mean, and again, the goal is always to get them to be able to deadlift, but because of the way the spinal loading is, sometimes you can get somebody to put a 100-pound sandbag on their hips and do a hip bridge, but they're not liable to pick up a 100-pound kettlebell.
Well, and again, I did plenty of sumo deadlifts back in the day, but again, and I have nothing against it. It's social friggin' media. Everyone's doing it now, and people are taking such a wide stance. The weight is probably coming off the ground 2 inches. It's like, all right, let's see you. You're doing supposedly 850 pounds. Great. I'm happy for you. Hope you blow out your back.
We talk about deadlifts?
Yeah.
Okay.
The sumo deadlift.
Oh, sumo deadlift, right.
Go ahead and do a deadlift. Switch right to a regular deadlift, and let me see you do that much weight. So if you can do the equivalent, okay, great. I'm happy for you. But when people are using the sumo deadlift as a way to not have to do the sumo or regular conventional deadlift, that's when I have a major problem with it. All these, especially guys, and girls, females do it too, but mostly the guys, they stand up there, they have their backwards hats on and they have their oversized headphones. They lift the weight up 4 inches off the ground, then they throw it down and then they jump for joy. It's like, oh man, that's the problem with social media. It's another pat on the ass.
Yeah.
So it kills me. So again, not a bad exercise, just the attention it annoys me.
Right.
The attention it doesn't deserve. So, all right, just to be back on track, I really went way off track on that one, but I figured it stirred up the emotion, so we might as well talk about it. You don't want to hold that stuff in. So what basically you were describing before I went off the rails is that you want to put them into a good posture to keep them there.
Mm-hmm.
Again, habit. We got to teach them that good habit over and over and over again. Now, the banded row, I think, is a great exercise because I also use that for people with lower cross syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
So now what I typically try to do is I'll teach them either how to facilitate their glutes or I'll teach them a pelvic tilt. Now the issue I have with the pelvic tilt, which we've talked in the past, is a lot of people overshoot it and now they reverse the curve in their lumbar spine. So that's not what it is. A pelvic tilt is purely the pelvis and it's not a lot of motion. So all we're trying to do is just drop it down 10 degrees maybe. And then what that does is it shortens the tissue in the anterior core, which now braces everything. And then I can go through, shoulder blades back, tuck your chin back. Now everything is working a little bit more efficient. Now, if someone is doing a banded row, just because you and I both talked about it, or rows in general, and they chin tuck, they shoulder blade squeeze, they tighten their glutes, their core's engaged, what is usually the most common comment that people will make to you when they start doing things the right way?
I mean, often it's a little more challenging.
Correct.
They notice it being a lot harder than they did before.
Yeah, and the common one that I hear is, I really have to concentrate.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
But that comes with the more challenging. Now, we may give them a light band, a red band, or whatever it may be, so it's not heavy, but now we've changed the way that they typically do things. They're like, I didn't expect it to be this hard. Yeah, because you're doing it the way your body has not become efficient with, and you're doing it the biomechanically correct way. You know, and then there are the people out there, well, do we need to? That's not what we're talking about. The bad position that brought them in, we're trying to correct that. So all the time, even just a tiny chin tuck when you're trying to raise your arms, you know, oh, I really have to concentrate. That's exactly what we want. We're building awareness, which again helps us change the habit. So, and you got to do that for a minimum of 3 weeks. To build a new habit, you have to do it for minimum 21 days. That's what all the research states. To reinforce it, now you got to do it for 6 weeks. And then hopefully at that point, there's more of an integration. So it's kind of like the trans-theoretical model of behavioral change. So it kind of follows those steps too. So you can fall out of it, but ideally you get to the point of maintenance, which maintenance for us would be we've gotten to the point that upper and lower cross syndrome are no longer the environment that we live in, and we just have to reinforce those good patterns by layering on strength. However, in your opinion, if someone continues strengthening, but they still assume upper and lower cross syndrome, what will that do to them down the road? So just add strength on top of their syndrome.
Gotcha. So like let's say that they're upper lower cross, but they keep doing bench press and squats without doing anything for the other side. They're going to run into issues with shoulder mobility, hip mobility. Not that necessarily these are the people that, you know, only trained bench and squats forever, but I mean the most extreme example is the old person who's completely bent forward and has to walk with a cane because their shoulders are parallel to the ground. Like, that is extreme upper and lower body cross.
Mm-hmm.
For those of you that can't picture it, that's essentially the most extreme example. They're going to run into shoulder issues between lack of range of motion, probably pain. They could run into all kinds of hip issues. There's all kinds of stuff.
And
falls. As they get older, they're more liable to fall because their weight is more forward.
Yeah.
They're more on their toes rather than being back on their heels.
And at the very least, when we look at, let's take away the pain and the actual conditions that can develop because of this, because it could be disc-related issues, number of things. All they're doing is just becoming dysfunctionally strong.
Mm-hmm.
Which then at that point, again, dysfunctional, we're taking away the functional aspect of what we're trying to accomplish. So I don't think a lot of people grasp that concept enough, that if we don't move correctly before we layer on strength, we just move shitty, but we're stronger. There are a small percentage of people that can probably get away with it, just putting strength on top of bad movement patterns. But that is a small, small minority.
And I think, and usually for those people, there's some other factor.
Uh-huh.
You know, like somebody who goes into the gym and 6 days a week trains only, you know, quads and chest. But, you know, maybe they have an active job where they're standing upright all day, or
sure,
they're in a, you know, so like it kind of offsets, usually the person who sits in a desk all day, or, you know, sits at a desk at a computer all day and only trains quads and yep. chest is going to have an issue.
Well, I think you just brought up a great point again of the offsetting. Yep. Because that's really what a lot of this comes down to. A lot of the activities that people do in daily life, there's no such thing as perfect posture. You have to put yourself in the most efficient positions where you're most resilient to not hurt yourself, which by biomechanical standards can be poor postures. Now, our body should be able to withstand the stress of poor postures as long as we're doing something to offset it when we're not in that task anymore. So if someone says, you know, I'm in a job where I have to bend forward all day long, well, then if they go to the gym and they do exercises where they're opening themselves back up, just for a lack of better terms, that is going to help them be better at their job because they're, one, showing the body a different stimulus, but they're also making the body more resilient to make sure that we can offset that forward stress. So it's like if we sit all day long, then you'll want to do something to open up those sitting muscles that are always tight. Have them do standing exercises and focus on posture. Open up the hips. So it's really just the exact opposite of what that task is requiring you to do. But again, it's a constant, you're constantly working at it. So when you become efficient with it, you no longer have to think about those positional changes anymore. And that's when you know you own the movement pattern all over again. So think about now when you're working out, and granted, you're probably more aware than the average bear, but how some of the movement patterns, you don't have to break them down for yourself the way that you do others. Now, it doesn't mean that you and I are perfect at them, but we've spent the time to do step one. Now we've blended step one with step two, and then step two with step three. Then we got to step three, then we could skip four and went straight to five. With someone who has a significant amount of syndromes, or they don't do anything to offset what they've done all day long, you really got to go slow. Here's step one. You need to master this before we can get to step two.
The one I always think of is, I know we've been talking about rows, but hinges.
Oh, yeah.
Hinges are one of the, are on that scale. It's like, you know, a graph where on the x-axis is how easy it is to do, and on the y-axis is how hard it is to teach. And it's like, it's completely uneven. It's like once somebody gets a hinge, you almost never have to, I mean, you may have to tell them, like, you know, pull your shoulders back and down, like once every few times. Once somebody has a hinge, they pretty much have it. Mm-hmm. But when you're trying to teach somebody to hinge that doesn't know what the actual movement is or doesn't have a feel for it, that's hard. And that's the one I thought of immediately when you said breaking it down into steps. Because when you're teaching somebody to hinge, I always break it down. It's like three steps. Step one, soften the knees. Okay, pause. Step two, pull the shoulders back. Pause. Step three, keep everything the same but try and touch your butt to the wall behind you. And usually people get that, but then you get to a point where you don't have to break it down any steps anymore. You just do it.
Yeah. What, to me, what's interesting is typically females are easier to teach a hinge than males. And I've never been able to figure that out other than when you read morphological changes, the actual center of gravity point, which for most of us is around S2, they say for females is actually a little bit lower. So that's the only thing that I could think of.
Did you ever see that social media thing that was going around for a while about picking up the chair?
Yeah.
I had no issue with it because I know how to hinge, but I remember I just remember seeing all the, like, women just
stand
it
right
was
up.
Nothing, and all the men just, like, couldn't figure out how to do it. It's just it was a funny.
Yeah, I did it because I'm like, well, this doesn't look that hard, and right. I did it, and I'm like, this is dumb, but it makes sense because it's very challenging to teach guys how to hinge. Usually they round from their back first.
Yeah.
So, and that's typically why they end up having flat backs, and those are the guys that typically will have what I call no butt syndrome, where it basically reverses the curve and their pelvis slides underneath them. So the hinge is an exercise I always tend to give even when someone has a lower cross syndrome, and then typically with upper cross syndrome I'm always teaching people at the minimum chin tucks. Mm-hmm. Chin tucks, scap retraction, that's the absolute minimum that I start with. So those are a lot of the exercises that I give on day one in rehab. You know, someone comes in with shoulder pain, Well, your shoulders rolled a little forward, head. These may be things that they could mean something, they could mean nothing. We're not too sure. However, we need to show your body that it can live on the spectrum of here versus here. I'm not even going to say good versus bad. It needs to be able to hit both ends of the range and be okay with it. As long as we can do that, I typically find that people do quite well. So stretching, strengthening, mobility work, all the stuff that we've talked about before, those are all the things that we recommend now. It's just we do have to be a little bit more aware when we're trying to correct these cross syndromes, which again, I wouldn't necessarily call them a syndrome, but they're more of a behavior or an environment that we live in. So just always something to consider, especially if you've heard before that your posture's not good, or your head sits too far forward, or your shoulders are rounded forward, or you have the increased arch in your back. It's not the end of the world. Your body has just decided it's a behavior that it needs to become very, very efficient with. And as long as we can at least attempt to reduce that or change the behavior in certain postures and tasks at the gym is really the place that we'd like to see it, then you can be in a bad posture and it's not going to be so bad for us.
And I think too, what has become a little bit more, I don't know if well-known, widespread, because I don't feel like it's that widespread in mainstream, in general population, like people don't have, it hasn't quite gotten there yet, but what I feel like has changed, at least in my field a little bit, is recognizing that posture is fluid.
Yeah.
Like it's not, there really isn't such a thing as a perfect, in quotes, a perfect posture for a person. The next time that you're just standing there, try standing with perfect posture. You've got your core turned on, you've got the shoulders pulled back and down. See how long you hold that position for. You can't, like a cross posture, especially lower body cross. There are a lot of people that walk around with a neutral posture up top, but have a more pronounced lower body cross, because that lower body cross is a more relaxed position.
Mm-hmm.
Like standing in a position that is the opposite of lower body cross, complete opposite, is difficult to keep up. But it's important that you're able to do it and those muscles function. But that doesn't mean that you can't ever stand like that, or it just means that you can't be stuck that way, for lack of a better way to put it.
And again, there's static posture and there's dynamic posture. And typically I'll tell people, posture's not really bad. However, it can give me an idea of how you hold yourself against gravity. So if someone's shrugging a little bit more on one side, we got to try to figure out why. If someone's shifting to one side compared to the other. So for me, it's part of the equation, but it's not the biggest piece. So as long as we can, again, develop strategies to help correct that, and then no harm, no foul. I don't know anyone who's ever been harmed from working on posture.
Nope.
I know plenty of people who've done just well not focusing on posture. So again, it works for some, may not work for others. So, all right, anything else you want to add in?
No, I think we hit that pretty good.
All right, so rather quick in the scheme of things, but we just wanted to give people an idea of what these so-called syndromes were. And again, most of us have one variation or both, and you can have both of them at the same time. Hopefully we've given you some ideas of what to work on, and if you see anyone with it, again, it's not the worst thing in the world, but it helps you to understand why neck pain may happen, shoulder pain, elbow pain, knee pain, hip pain, and so on and so forth. So you guys know the drill at this point. If there's any questions that you have, comments, certainly feel free to reach out with the information that's listed below. And until next week, take care.
Later, guys.